This hour, we're talking with writers about some of the problems they've encountered as mothers, or with their own mothers. Historian Margaret Jacobs studies the history of women and gender. Her latest book, White Mother to a Dark Race, looks at early 20th century policies in both the U.S. and Australia that removed Indigenous children from their homes, allegedly to educate and assimilate them. Some of the most powerful advocates of these policies were white women. Many women reformers believed the policies were needed to improve the lives of Indigenous families. But Jacobs told Steve Paulson that for Aboriginal children like Margaret Tucker, these removal policies meant growing up in constant fear.
One day when Margaret was at the school, she was about 12 or 13 years old. While her mother was away working, state authorities came, policemen, and they tried to remove Margaret and her sister and cousin from the school. Somebody in the community, especially actually the missionary woman there who was appalled that this might happen without Margaret Tucker's mother knowing, sent word to her mother, and her mother came rushing to the school just in time. She tried to stop the authorities from taking her child. The police intervened, and they said that, you know, she couldn't stop this. This was going to happen. A policeman sort of patted his holster, showing her that if she tried to resist, he would use force. And they whisked the girls away in the police car. Margaret Tucker's mother chased the car for a while. And Margaret Tucker learned much later in life that her mother had just sort of broken down and wept on the way as the children were being whisked away. And it took her a long time to recover from this.
So it was not just taking these children out of the local schools. It was taking them away from their families as well. It was basically raising them as white children.
Yes. What happened to Margaret Tucker was she was taken to a home called Cootamundra. Cootamundra was a home established for Aboriginal girls that was mainly to train them to be domestic servants. Once trained, they were placed in the homes of white families in Australia to work as domestic servants. The idea that was basically that they would eventually become sort of part of Australian society, albeit at the kind of lower levels of kind of unskilled labor force. The white Australian state governments, they believed they had some sort of Aboriginal problem, and they believed it was a problem that Aboriginal people and their cultures and their claims to land were persisting, and that these were out of step with the efforts they were trying to make to build a new nation.
Hmm. Now, it turns out there was a very similar policy in the American West. The children of American Indians mm-hmm. were also removed from their families. How close are the parallels?
The way we tend to think about them in the West is that these children were removed, or they were sent to be educated in boarding schools. And that always seems so much more positive, doesn't it, than removing children. But when I started to dig into it more, it seemed to me that really it was a very similar parallel situation, not entirely the same, but similar. I found lots of accounts of military forces, police forces coming into Indian communities to remove children to go to school. There were other ways they removed children as well. They were things like withholding rations for Indian families if they refused to send their children to school. There were other efforts that were more what we would think of as persuasion, cajoling Indian peoples, telling them that this was the way that they would gain an ability to stand up for their own rights. There was a lot of resistance to this among American Indian families because sometimes early on, a leader in the community might say, okay, this, you know, this makes sense. I'm going to send my children to school so they can learn to stand up for our rights and it'll, you know, be better for all of us. They'll become mediators. But oftentimes when the children were sent to school, there was great sickness and disease in the schools. Many children died in the schools. And sometimes when children came back, they had lost the ability to communicate in their own languages. They were alienated. And gradually, many tribes became very opposed to this policy. And that's when the government started moving in with more heavy-handed methods to try to force children into the schools. And the federal government had, I believe, quite similar aims to state governments in Australia, seeing Indian children as the means to assimilate Indian people at large. Mm.
Now, the central paradox in this story, in both the United States and Australia, is that some of the strongest advocates for the removal of indigenous children were white women activists mm-hmm. who were progressives mm-hmm. in a lot of mm-hmm. other ways. They campaigned to limit child labor, to reduce infant mortality, to promote child care. How could they advocate the, in some cases, the forcible removal mm-hmm. of native-born children from their own families?
Well, this was the question that puzzled me as well. I knew, as a historian of women and gender, that this was a time period in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in which white women were using, you might call it the politics of motherhood, to advocate for the rights of women. They considered motherhood sacrosanct, and they considered that their political activity was based on their roles as mothers. These were white middle-class women, usually Protestant. They believed that they had a lot to offer women who they saw as disadvantaged, and this was often women of other races or women of the working class.
Were there certain aspects of Native culture of the way children were raised in either in Australia or in the American West that led to this campaign to remove the Native-born children?
Well, there were several ways in which white women believed that Indigenous families were aberrant or were so different that they warranted removal of their children. One of these was that many Indigenous communities raised their children often in extended families. And this is an era in which the nuclear family in both Australia and the United States is becoming more and more paramount. Many Indigenous groups moved around seasonally. They followed their food sources. And in a society in which the home was revered, the sort of stable, permanent home was revered by white women as a source of their power in many respects, many white women looked on the lack of a permanent home as a problem within Indigenous communities. They also tended to think that Indigenous women were degraded by having to do manual labor and work within their communities. I could go on with all the list of the ways which white women sort of thought Indigenous women were not fulfilling their rightful role as women and that they needed to teach them how to do this and that they eventually came to the conclusion that the way to do this was to remove their children, to teach them the proper ways of mothering, womanhood. And for boys, they wanted to teach them what they thought were the proper ways that men should behave too. And so that, for example, in the United States, they really sought to promote farming for boys, which you can imagine was often traumatic for these children because in their communities they had learned that men don't farm. So there were all sorts of ways in which these schools and institutions were really undermining long-time beliefs about what was the proper role of men and women. These are so fundamental to any society.
How important were the white women in carrying out this policy? Mm-hmm. I mean, did they help give legitimacy to the government's aims to assimilate these mm-hmm. these indigenous children?
Well, absolutely. And especially in the United States, white women gained great sort of authority in this area. In fact, in 1898, a woman named Estelle Riel was appointed to be superintendent of Indian education. She held that post in the federal government for 12 years. And during that time, she supported a compulsory school law for American Indian children. This didn't just mean that they should have to go to school wherever they lived. It really meant they had to be forced to leave their communities and go to boarding schools.
Now, these policies were in effect for decades. What finally led to their demise? Did Indians and Aboriginals finally manage to rally public outrage to end them?
This is a very good point. In the United States, in the 1920s, a group of white people who have become very opposed to this policy, they organize a campaign against it. They work with many Indian groups who oppose the boarding schools. And for a time in the 1930s, under Franklin Roosevelt's administration, the policy shifts away from the use of boarding schools. But surprisingly, after World War II, boarding schools remain in force. The government switches back to a policy of assimilation of Indian peoples. And in the late 20th century, as late as the 1970s, you still had about 30,000 Indian children in boarding schools. And in addition to that, by the late 20th century, you have the practice of greater numbers of Indian children in foster care and the child welfare system, and many more being adopted out by white families. By the 1960s and 70s, Indian peoples have started really organizing in force against what you might generally call child removal. And by 1978, they've been successful in getting something passed called the Indian Child Welfare Act, which was mainly about trying to stop the fostering and adoption of children, but also address the high numbers of children that were still in boarding schools at that time.
So from today's perspective, how should we look back on this? Has this policy of removing children from their families to some degree shaped life today in both Australia mm-hmm. and the United States?
Well, it surely has. And, you know, if you talk to Indigenous peoples, this is a very important issue to them. Australia has been quite, this has been a quite public issue there. This started to come out in the late 1990s. And finally, just I believe it was in 2008, maybe 2009, the Prime Minister of Australia issued a public apology for the removal of Aboriginal children. This has been a much less public issue in the United States. But I believe that, you know, if we truly care about what the Australians term reconciliation and moving forward as a society in which Indigenous people are finally sort of given their full rights, this is an issue that we really need to reckon with and cover more fully in the public view.
Margaret Jacobs teaches history at the University of Nebraska. Her book, White Mother to a Dark Race, won the prestigious Bancroft Prize in 2010. She spoke with Steve Paulson.